Okay, I think what I'll do is give background to a lot of this material for people who aren't that familiar with coronal problems. And I'll also try to get into enough specifics of the results that those in the field will, you know, get an idea of what we're doing as well. So what I'll be talking about is results from the TRACE satellite. That actually stands for something. That's Transition Region and Coronal Explorer. And the corona is the outer atmosphere of the sun. The transition region is the part of the atmosphere that's between the corona and the surface of the sun, specifically the chromosphere, technically. And the idea is to trace out the connections, the flow of mass and energy up from the surface into the corona. This particular image that I'm showing is actually, that's not a trace image. That's from my last rocket flight. Last as in most recent, but maybe last forever. Who knows? I don't know. Sounding rockets are, it's a tough business. It's a hard way to make a living. But this is a, I'm showing this because this is a spectral line that's never been seen before. This is nickel 17, so it's 16 times ionized nickel, temperature of about 3 million degrees. Not one of the lines that people usually think of looking at, but I think it is rather interesting. Maybe one of these days we'll get a satellite up looking at this temperature regime. What?
What is the wavelength?
249 angstroms.
Why is it particularly interesting? Because it's hot?
There are very few lines available to multilayers. You know, this technique that we use to make X-ray images, there are very few lines available at the temperatures where most of the corona is formed. It's an unfortunate situation, but we have to live with it. There are lines available at lower temperatures and at higher temperatures. But most of the active regions, most of the active corona is at 3 to 5 million degrees. There are no spectral lines around that can be used to, with this multilayer technology. The multilayers, by the way, are the way we get high resolution imaging. You apply an artificial Bragg crystal to the surface of a telescope and you diffract the X-rays back. And of course, the spacing of the layers is the wavelength that you're trying to work at. So at very short X-ray wavelengths, it's impossible to make layers that are thin enough and smooth enough to actually get diffraction effects. So that's a big limitation on the technique. So you have to work at slightly longer wavelengths, and there just aren't any spectral lines at 4 or 5 million degrees. So I was hoping this one would be suitable, and you know, it looks like it is. It's an interesting line to think about using. Okay, now why is it, there we go, okay. These are the people whose work I'll be talking about. This is our little group, the Solar and Stellar Outpost of the High Energy Physics Division at the CFA, mostly X-ray astronomy people, and they don't mind that we look at the sun.
As long as you don't do it with Chandra.
Right, that's for sure, yes. They are very upset with us. We keep shutting them off whenever a big flare goes off. They go into safe mode, and they come down and yell at me.
Ask if people were even more upset with you, right?
Yes, yes. And in fact, Yoko, the solar satellite, was lost because of an eclipse. They didn't expect to see a total eclipse, as it turned out, and their aspect system just couldn't figure out what to do with it and went tumbling away. Well, such is life. Okay, so here are the main problems in coronal physics. I think people would generally agree with this. 100 years ago, the corona was a big problem. It couldn't be explained, actually. It was one of the biggest problems in astrophysics. It extends way far away from the sun. It looks like it has a temperature of about 5,000 or 6,000 degrees, so it shouldn't have extended that far out. It's filled with spectral lines that nobody could identify, so it seemed to be a physical impossibility. In 1939, finally, Grotrian and Ed Lynn figured out that all these strange spectral lines you were looking at were very high ionization stages of metals like iron and calcium, which are in the corona, in the solar atmosphere, but at very low abundance. But they were very highly ionized, meaning they were very hot, millions of degrees. And then suddenly everything made sense. The corona is hot, that's why it sticks so far out. These are elements that are in ionization stages you don't usually see, which is why there were all these peculiar spectral lines. And the problem since then has been to explain why it's so hot. You know, ordinary thermodynamic processes don't get you from a 6,000 degree surface to a 2 or 3 or 4 million degree gas above the surface. Additional problems have developed since then. With further observation, the corona is highly structured, as you saw in that first picture I showed you. It also turns out to be very dynamic and very unstable. And these are, I think we would agree, the three major problems in coronal physics. And linking all of those, so to speak, seems to be the magnetic field. I just noticed that when I switched from Windows 98 to Windows XP, my symbols, that wasn't an arrow. Anyway, it's an appropriate symbol. The emergence of magnetic field from inside the sun into the atmosphere seems to be responsible for heating the corona, structuring it, and making it dynamic and unstable. And I'll give you an example in a minute of what the field does when it goes into the atmosphere. Right now, I'm having trouble because there it went. Okay, my cursor disappeared. The first question is, why do we use X-rays to observe the corona? The easy answer is that that's where the emission is. At 3 or 4 million degrees, the corona emits mainly X-rays. This, though, is another way to look at the problem. Up on top was X-rays. The middle panel is a transition region temperature, carbon 4, so it's at an intermediate kind of temperature. Now you can see there's activity, and it's quite rapid activity, actually. In the transition region, events tend to happen more quickly, but you know there's much less to be seen there. And then, of course, in white light, pretty much all you see is sunspots. So this is the same exact region at the same time. Okay, so that's the difference, what happens when you go to X-rays. Now this I'd like to play several times and talk a bit about it. This is what happens when an active region, when magnetic flux emerges into the corona. Here's a region. We've got new magnetic field coming up. This, by the way, is one day of observation. Frames every 30 seconds for a day. You're looking toward the limb, so things are greatly foreshortened. There's another region here over the limb. It's about 200,000 kilometers away from where this region emerges. I wanted to point out, I was talking this morning with some people about the connections that develop when magnetic flux emerges into the corona. It has effects not just locally, and they're very dramatic, but very far away. You'll see that in less than a day, an enormous magnetic connection develops to this region that's way over the limb. And you'll see it just sort of appears quite suddenly.
What wavelength? I mean, this is what energy?
This is the iron 10. See, here's the connection that's developing. It just appeared out of nowhere. This is 1 million degrees. Okay, it's the trace 171 angstrom channel.
But you have to be careful, Evans. Just because that particular connection was lit up doesn't mean there wasn't some connection that wasn't lit up before.
Possibly. I mean, you could have fields from this region connecting everywhere on the sun. It's possible. But certainly this region did not know that one was going to appear. I don't think that's very likely. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you talk about the effects that regions have, they're very large scale. There's no question about that. That's really the point of this. Okay, so here's a little outline. I may not get to the what's next part. We'll see if you want to hear that or not. But it turns out that the trace observations really have contributed to all three of those areas, coronal heating, structuring, and dynamics. I'll see how much I can tell you about it today. This is a point I'd like to emphasize, that, and I'll show you a single observation that illustrates all of this, that there really is not one thing happening in the corona. There are places where there's steady heating. There are places where, as you just saw, emerging flux changes everything, and you get what are called nanoflares by some people. Little tiny reconnection events. There are also, I'm sure you've heard in the past few months about quasi-separatrix layers, something I thought was just the theorist's fiction, but I think we actually do see such things in these data. So I'm forced to believe in them. And this, that the models of the coronal structure up until now have basically been static models. Okay, there's a slow evolution of the magnetic field, but the modeling of a given structure was taken to be in hydrostatic equilibrium, slowly evolving. And it may be slowly evolving, but I will argue that it's not in equilibrium. And this will show you why. Oops, come on. Okay. Okay. All four of those processes are happening here. I'll start with this funny little thing. It's an unusual structure, but it does show these little nanoflare events very nicely. This is a little bit of one magnetic polarity that's emerged within an opposite polarity. Okay, so you almost certainly have a lot of reconnection of magnetic fields going on around the boundary there. But what you're seeing here, all these little flashes are field lines that are being lit up by very short bursts of energy input.
You think that's outlining the separatrix surface
there? Yes, I think so. Right, that's the boundary between the fields. And this is clearly, you know, episodic heating, nanoflares or whatever you want to call it. And this is something that's been talked about for a long time. It's, you know, this is a nice example of it. And there's been a big debate whether the corona is heated by this type of process, lots of little events, or by some steady process. Okay, and I'm saying both. Where there is emerging magnetic flux in an active region, you see this sort of thing. Otherwise, what you see is this. And I have to explain what that is.
But can we go back to the separatrices? Are you saying there's actually emergence going on as we're seeing these things flash?
There is interaction between one magnetic polarity and another.
Okay.
That's
no,
what's happening.
I wouldn't doubt that. I wondered if maybe
because
there was an emergence rate that could correlate with certain the
frequency. I think that does generally happen. You know, you get new magnetic flux emerging in an active region, and typically you see this sort of thing. It's maybe not in this shape, you know, it's more linear shape.
Yeah.
But that is the sort of thing you see when you have new magnetic flux emerging in an active region.
This is it's a temperature map? I think it's an intensity. It's intensity.
What you're looking at is 1 million degree plasma.
So it's intensity at one particular temperature?
Yeah.
And it's proportional to density squared.
Yes. In fact, as I'm about to tell you, what you're seeing here is 5 million degree plasma. Okay? That was what I was about to say next. Typically, in active regions, the corona is 3, 4, 5 million degrees. That's too hot for this spectral line to be formed. But I've drawn it on the board off to the side here. Okay, if you have a structure in the corona that's 5 million degrees at the top, and it connects down to a surface that's at 6,000 degrees, somewhere it's going to go through a million. Okay? So what we're seeing there is actually the transition region of such a hot loop. And in fact, you can do a simple calculation, and you can find that the brightness that we see is proportional to the cube of the temperature at the top of the loop, which is the same as being proportional to the pressure.
That's assuming
that it's static. Now, I'll argue that it's static because, in fact, first of all, we can also check, is there hot plasma here? There is another satellite up, or there was, YOCO, which was lost a few months ago, but they had an X-ray telescope that could see the hot plasma. You put a YOCO image on top of this one, and what they see sits right above here. Now, this MOS is very useful for the next study we want to do, which is comparing where these structures meet up to the magnetic field that you can see at the surface. Okay, I'll get to that in a while. But this is ideal for that, because you can see the foot points of the structures without all that stuff obscuring your view on top. The point about this, though, is suppose that this were heated by transient events like that. And I'll show it to you. I'll show you the equations that go with this statement later. But you wouldn't see it like this. What you would see is these little foot points brightening. Then you'd see evaporation of material up into the corona, and that material would then cool radiatively. Okay, so you would see transient loops in the corona above here, just like you're seeing there, as a matter of fact. And you don't see them. So there's something else going on here. That's a steady process, or effectively steady. That's the next thing I'm showing. Right.
What is the time scale for this? This
is every 30 seconds for 2 hours, and the movie is looping.
Could I interpret the sort of glimmering that I see, the shimmering that I see in MOS, as a sequence of these brightenings?
Except that I don't see the other part of the loop going through this temperature.
Right. Yeah. You never see the cooling event above there. What happens is this stuff is getting pushed around by the fluid motions of the surface. Mm-hmm. So the reason it looks so dynamic is because it's getting pushed all over the place.
But glowing steadily the whole time, it just gets moved around.
It gets moved around, it gets fragmented, it gets combined with other elements.
Mm-hmm. Is there enough resolution to follow that in detail to see whether there are things that fade in and out, or whether they're always there and just move?
There is. I don't have movies of that. I have an image that I'll show you of this detailed comparison of what this stuff is doing at very high magnification. Okay, but this, I believe, is a quasi-separatrix layer. you have this brightening, which sort of appears out of nowhere for no obvious reason.
Can you tell if they're brightening because they're cooling down through this temperature, or whether they're brightening because they're cooling up through the temperature?
Yeah, you can tell, actually. With a series with a time series, you can construct, by looking at the brightness history, you can see material flowing up and then the whole thing cooling down or collapsing as if it were cooling. Even from a single temperature, you can tell that there's been some energy release on the field lines. You have it fill up with material and then it cools. Okay, we did a whole paper on analyzing that kind of sequence of events from a single wavelength. Yeah, you really can tell.
Is there a continuum initial absorbing continuum? Is it free or bound?
We've had a lot of argument about that. The oscillator strength of this line that we're looking at is about 1. I mean, the optical depth is a little less than 1 or a little more than 1, depending on where you look. So in this context, it's called resonant scattering. Right? So it's... I think you just asked me 2 questions. That's one question, is whether this is optically thin or not. And the answer to that is sort of. As far as continuum goes, at these temperatures, there is a little bit of continuum emission at a very low level. As you say, bound free, free, a little bit. That becomes more important at higher temperatures. The multi-layer that we use has a certain width, so it will include a piece of the continuum, if there is continuum, and we actually can use that in flares to do a temperature analysis, because in flares, when the temperature gets 10 million degrees or 20 million degrees, then you have continuum, and we have several passbands. So we can look at the ratio in the 2 passbands to get a temperature, actually.
Do you have vector magnetograms for this region, time sequence? Yeah. I find it difficult to understand what's going on in the photosphere field while all these different features are happening. I wonder if there's a signature for each one that you could identify in a vector.
Oh, we've tried. It hasn't worked out very well. You can't make any sense of what you see so far.
Just boundaries. You must see polarity boundaries. And
well, what you see is those little knots, like in the G band. You see the little bright knots, which is where the magnetic field presumably is.
Right. So what's under the moss? Is that the place?
I'll get to that. That's a very interesting question. It's not what you expect. That's that drawing.
Looking at this picture, there seems to be one arch which is close in the orbit.
Here?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think they're all closed.
But then you have the majority of very huge arches.
These.
Right.
That's what I was about to talk about next.
Which all go in one direction. Do they have the same or different polarities?
These typically emanate around sunspots where you have moderately strong field.
Yeah.
And they connect to regions on the sun very far away.
Okay. Right. But at the foot point, what is the polarity there?
It's the polarity of the sunspot. There's actually a sunspot here, another sunspot there. I should have brought the white light picture. There are lots of sunspots in this region.
It's all the same then, of course.
Yeah, it's the same. But I think you can see, even with this funny stuff, that it looks better here. Anyway, you can see there's outflow. There's steady, continuous outflow here. Also here, and here, and here. All of these.
I'm sorry, so there's outflow, but you think these are all closed places on other...
Right, and I'll show you a little bit of that. At the other end, there has to be downflow.
Is the downflow actually a doubler? I mean, can you see this doubler shift?
We're trying. It's hard to get simultaneous observations with SUMR. The question is it material flowing or is it a wave? And we've had big debates about that. At the other end, we have observations at lower temperatures and we see downflows at the other end of this. I'll show you that in a minute.
Before we move on, with those loops up over in the upper left there,
yes.
It's interesting that for some of them, the brightening seemed to start at one end and move along the loops, and yet there's a fainter one where it seems to brighten the entire loop all at once, the one on the top.
Yeah, it seems to. I agree. When you actually do the analysis of the densities, the intensity levels, it is not simultaneous. It actually comes up from the brightening comes up from the foot points, even though it looks to, yeah, right.
But does it come up from both or just one?
Typically what happens, if you have a loop mm-hmm. and you put energy in asymmetrically off to one side, the opposite end will brighten first. That's the way it works out with these models. Very strange, but that's just the way it happens. Okay, I want to talk about the flows right now because that's sort of been the most contentious issue. You've seen that in these pictures there are these very long loops. Here's one seen at the limb. There are others going off to the side here. If these structures were your typical hydrostatic loop, which has been modeled for 30 years now, it would look like this, okay? If the gas in this loop had the pressure scale height that's appropriate to the temperature that we see, okay, you have KT over MG is the atmospheric scale height, then this would look like that. Okay, so clearly these are not loops that are in hydrostatic equilibrium. I'll just show you that there are lots of them. Okay, these are examples from several different years. You just always see structures like this. And these are the ones that I was just showing you with what look like flows. Now, one of the groups doing work in this, in trying to explain this, is arguing that these are actually made up of many different temperature structures. Okay, a multi-temperature model, they're saying. Lots of little threads, each with a range of temperatures from 1 million to 5 million degrees, and they can add up to give the appearance of being a single structure. Okay? Now, I am instead taking the view that we seem to see flows. We've done models where you have flows, and the question is, does it explain what we see? Okay? So, that's the view I've been pursuing.
So if you have flows and you have a power law density variation instead of an exponential one?
I'll show you what you get. I don't know what to call it. But just first let me show you. Here's a region we looked at with Trace where you had SUMER observations simultaneously, and then there were also CDS observations. CDS is an instrument on SOHO that sees a lot of different spectral lines. It's actually a spectrograph, and they can build up an image by rastering their slit. The advantage is that they can see other temperatures than what we see. So they can look to see whether there are multiple temperatures in these structures. SUMER is a high-resolution spectrograph that operates in the UV. They can see Doppler shifts. Okay, and here's what you see with SUMER. This is where those structures were in this particular image. They were at the opposite end from where we saw upflows. So it's not perfect. We didn't get SUMER to look where we were seeing upflows. But they see redshifts in these structures, which means downflows, and these are at lower temperatures. So it would fit my suggestion that this stuff goes up hot and comes down cold.
What's the temperature difference between those two?
Carbon 4 is at about 100,000 degrees. Neon 8 is at about 400,000. So they're both quite below the million that we see.
But the bottom one is hotter than the top.
That's velocity. Oh yeah, it's a higher. It's hotter. There are troubles with the velocity scale. Big arguments about that. Yes, they are. They stay for days. Okay. Here's the intensity measured along the loop. As I said, we had several different passbands. So this is a 1.5 million degree passband. It's iron 12. This is what that loop would look like in iron 12 if there were no flow. Right? And this is what we actually see. And what we did, this was a real dynamic model. We actually solved the equations. You put in asymmetric heating. The assumption in all these models is that these coronal structures are heated from the bottom up. So you send energy up into the loop. There's no obvious reason why both ends should be getting the same amount of heating. So what we did was we put some asymmetry in the heating. In this case, one foot point was getting 15% more than the other foot point. Okay? And that's what you wind up with, the solid line. Okay? And it fits the intensity both in shape and in, you know, actual intensity.
Is that the end that's being heated? Well, this is distance along the loop, so is it asymmetric?
Yes, this is from the end that's being heated. I'll show you both ends in a minute. Okay, and then you ask, what does the other passband look like? And it fits pretty well in that passband, too. Yeah, I mean, we use this one to do the fitting, so it certainly is better than this, which is what it would have been without any asymmetry, without any flows.
So that's an asymmetry in the amount of heating. How does it even distribute the height,
then?
Does it depend on that?
You have to assume a scale height for the heating. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what we assumed. I think that, you know, there's so many parameters.
I
think we kept the same scale height, but only made the intensity higher at 1 foot point. Just try to keep it simple. So here's what the temperature distribution from 1 foot point to the other would look like if it were a hydrostatic standard model. Here's what it looks like with the asymmetric heating. You can see a little bit of asymmetry there. This is what the density in the loop looks like. Another problem that came up with trying to fit these big long loops is that they kept coming out with very high densities. The amount of material in the loop was just much higher than you would expect from the brightness of the loop. There's a problem to explain that. And here it comes out quite naturally. When you put a flow in a loop, it disappears, basically. You have to increase the density that's in the loop to get it to show up once there's a flow in it. I don't know how to explain it in words.
Can I just try to understand this temperature structure? You've
yes.
got a flow to the right in that
yes.
solid curve.
Right.
And the heat is being applied in two places, so those are where the two little bumps are?
Yeah.
Roughly.
Now they're being applied here and here, but with an exponential
okay.
scale height.
And that's...
But, you know, this includes conductive cooling at the foot points,
mm-hmm.
right?
I just wonder if because in static loop models, no matter where you heat it, you always have a maximum somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, the conduction alone can't do anything but go down the temperature gradient. But here, do you have some sort of adiabatic cooling or something as the material expands? Is there a cross section?
Yeah, the flow would be a cooling.
Would be a cooling.
Yeah.
But is the flow actually cool one side to the other?
It does. Well, there are two bumps. Where it comes down, it's gone up again.
I mean, I think this particular, well, I can't even say that. If it were a static loop, this would be unstable. But with a flow, I guess it's not.
There are these 1D hydro models of brain
yes.
losses and
right.
induction.
Yeah, we did not spend a huge amount of time trying to find the perfect fit to the data. This was just an attempt to see, is it at all in the right direction?
Yeah, right.
What else? Then there's the velocity distribution, which you can see comes to, 10, 15 kilometers per second at the top. The flows we see are somewhat faster than that, 20, 30 kilometers per second. But it's not a bad fit. I mean, everything goes in the direction of what we're seeing. That's my main point. Now, the question of a multi-temperature model. We have these CDS observations, and you can't see what all these spectral lines are. But there are a whole variety of temperatures. Neon 8, there's the trace. That's magnesium 9.
Are they in the temperature sequence?
Yes. No, they're not. When I transferred this from one program to another, you just lose. This is calcium 10. That's magnesium 10, silicon 12. On the right is the important thing. See, basically, each spectral line has an emission curve that it goes like this. The spectral line, is not formed at low temperatures. It's not formed at higher temperatures. It's got some maximum temperature where it's got some temperature where it's maximally formed. So in each of these pass bands, you see the structure with a certain brightness. And you ask how much material would be needed to see that amount of brightness in that line. Okay, and what you get is a series of curves like this, where the minimum is at the temperature where that line is maximally formed. So we have 8 different lines. And you ask, is there a place where they all give you the same answer? So if you ask, can you explain all of these observations by assuming this material is all at a certain temperature? Okay? And indeed, you can, All of them agree that this much material at this temperature can explain what you see. So I don't think you need to go to a multi-temperature explanation for this.
From a pedagogical point of view, I was wondering whether this would be enough, because for teaching people about analyzing lines, this would be a wonderful example.
Example of what?
When it works. Of
how you use them, yeah.
These techniques.
I was pleased with it.
Yeah.
Okay, now. The last bit of this story, and then I'll show you the little diagram on the right, where I'm going to tell you that everything we thought about the corona is all wrong. There have been studies done with TRACE and combining with the best ground-based data you can get, which is at the Swedish Vacuum Tower Telescope. And I won't show you all of these. We'll just concentrate on this one, which is calcium K at very high spatial resolution, and the trace moss, the little foot points. Okay? Calcium K can be used to tell you where the magnetic field is at the surface. And it tends to be in little granular lumps. It's very intermittent at the surface of the sun. So that's what you see in calcium. And we've traced the contours of that onto this diagram. So those little green contours are where the magnetic field is. The red contours are where the foot points of the coronal structures are. And they just don't meet up the way you expected them to. I mean, if anything, they're anti-correlated. right? I mean, here you have it sort of avoiding the magnetic field location. Same here. Okay, the magnetic field seems to avoid where the foot points of the coronal structures are. And what I think is going on is this, that the standard way we've been modeling the corona up until now is basically a magnetic bottle. You have very concentrated field at the surface. The field expands, okay, when it gets up into the corona. That's a secondary consideration, I think. But basically, you've got plasma that's confined inside the magnetic field. It's like a bottle. And that kind of model would lead you to expect to see this. You'd have the X-ray emission in structures that come down and meet up with the locations of the magnetic field elements. That's certainly what we expected to see. What we're seeing instead is schematically something like this. You have magnetic field elements, and the X-ray emission is where they aren't, which makes me think that what's going on is, you know, here's the magnetic field, and the plasma is in between, like this. It's constrained by the field, but it's not confined by it. And we see that it's flowing. So I think all of the physics of the situation is happening right in there.
Could I ask, what about your idea that quasi-separatrix layers may be important?
Well, that's what I'm thinking you've got in here.
You've got it all the way along that, where you've drawn P.
All the way along, so yes.
It doesn't have to be P, but just that's where the reconnection
is. It's still a coronal limb. It's just that the foot points aren't where you think they are.
Well, is it? I don't know what to call this region that's in between the loops.
Separatrix.
Yeah, that's what I would think you call it, yeah.
Still magnetic field. Oh, absolutely. Just so happens, yeah, though, that the neighboring magnetic field lines have very different connections, which makes them...
But in addition,
it may or may not be, but you see a lot of emission from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I can't figure out at the moment is what's happening down here. I'm not even sure what should be happening down there.
Did you purposely draw the arrows the way you did, or could that be anti-parallel in that intervening layer?
These magnetic fields?
Yeah. Could you have an opposite pole on the second little funnel?
Yeah, you could. You don't have to. And the places I've been showing, I think, are generally all in the same direction. I think the field is all in the same direction in those places. I would guess if it's oppositely directed, you have a much shorter lived situation.
So the idea is you just have the field just changes direction.
Tangential discontinuity, maybe. I don't know what. That's your job.
What happens at the bottom is, I think, actually both pieces of that bodies can be modeled.
I'd be interested to see it because, you know, we're trying to design experiments now. It'll be nice to know what to look for.
So Leon, how confident are you get the coal lined up right?
This particular work I didn't do, but these people worked very hard. You know, Gordon Sharmer, Bart DePonthieu, Tom Berger.
There's some internal consistencies that you can see in the sense that the shapes anti-match quite well in a lot of the places. If it was just shifted or distorted, that probably wouldn't be the case.
Right.
Did you have a trace white light band? I guess that's an issue for Bart and Lindsay.
Yeah. Yeah.
The trouble with the calcium 2K line is that, you know, that's really collage kind of emissions that you're seeing, right?
Sure. But I think they've done it with G band also.
Looking at the polarity, it doesn't give you the polarity information.
Yeah. And you realize, of course, you know, for co-alignment, you've got the bigger image. And especially if there's a pore or a sunspot, you can line it up quite well. So that's the sort of stuff we'll be doing with Solar B, where we have reliable high-resolution observations all the time. You know, on the ground, you can get really good data, but it's very rare. Okay, let me just quickly, this might be less interesting, because when it comes to flares, we have actually confirmed what everyone expected to see, for the most part. Let's go quickly through this if I can. The key thing here is we have two different channels with trace which see roughly the same temperature. This sees iron 9, this sees iron 12, but in addition to the iron 12, there is an iron 24 line. So these are both sensitive to about 1,000,000 degrees, but this one can also see 20 million degree plasma. And as you'll see when a flare goes off, let me see if I can pause it. Okay, what you're seeing here is post-flare loops. This is the last stage of a flare. And I'll get into the stages in a minute with the next graph. But basically, this connects the opposite magnetic polarities. Okay, and you typically have a filament that has erupted and led to that. And in fact, there's the filament coming out at you. It was lying right in here. Okay, this filament was right here. I don't know if the program will let me back up, but you'll see the filament coming back down, right? There it is. So it was right in there. And then don't change software, okay? I bought a new computer just so I could have XP. There was no way to install it on the old one. Okay, so the filament has left from in here. You have the two flare ribbons developing. So energy has been put down into the chromosphere. It is in the process of evaporating up into the corona right now. But the really interesting thing is here, where you can see the 20 million degree plasma, you have this extra feature, which isn't here. Okay, that's 20 million degrees. And that is sitting right where the filament was. I'll show you a little more of that, if I can get it to go to the next line. Come on. Okay, this is a different event, but it's the same sequence. There was a filament sitting in here. It's erupting upward. You can sort of see it. In a movie, you can see it. What you get is some brightenings at the foot points. Okay, so energy has been released from up above, coming down into the chromosphere. You get material evaporated upward. It then cools, and you have post-flare loops. So these post-flare loops are the most obvious part of the event, but sort of the least interesting. Now, what we did was, I'm going to talk about two different parts of this. One is this evaporation process. So we'll examine, is that really what's happening? And then I'll come back to that hot material up at the top. What we did was we took a little region here and we calculated, I say we, it was Spiro Antiochus who calculated it, what should the time history of that little foot point be? Considering that this is the process you're going after. You put energy into it, it evaporates upward. At the beginning, radiative losses, gravity, and all that are negligible until you get enough material that radiative cooling dominates. Okay, so you can calculate the differential emission measure that we should be seeing as a function of time. That's what you get. And there are two extreme situations that we considered. One is where you have a delta function input, okay, and then you just have a history of the region afterwards. And the other is where you have steady heating, just continued energy input to that same field line. So sort of two extreme situations. For the delta function, you get this brightness history, sort of linear. For the continued heating, you get a sort of a almost a square parabolic history. Okay? And then you ask, what did we actually see? This is the region we were looking at. You see the brightening looks just like that 5/7 power. So it really looks like on any given field line you have a delta function heating input.
Delta function in time.
In time, yes.
And it's uniform along there? Is that the assumption? I forgot what the first slide showed. In space. It said, I don't remember.
Uniform. Yes, yes, uniform, right. Now, oops, come on. Here is four different wavelengths. This is Lyman alpha. It's a 20,000 degree line. The flare is happening up here. The chromosphere brightens up, and then you get post-flare loops forming later. This is very high temperature. This is the SXT, the X-ray telescope on Yoko. This is the iron 9 channel, where you see only the low temperature, the 1 million degree plasma. And this is the other channel where you see the hot stuff too. And the main difference between these two, look up there. Okay, look what happens up on top. That's that bar of emission that we saw. It appears first. In fact, it appears simultaneous with those brightenings. Okay? And if I let it run long enough, you might see that.
How does it compare to the X-ray? Is it simultaneous with the very high temperature?
With that high temperature, yes.
It also appears to move up.
And it keeps moving upward.
About the same rate that the post-flare loops are moving upward.
The whole mess moves up together. I'll show you. This is just a comparison of the intensities. I will show you the whole mess moving up together. Okay, here's just a sequence, but I'll show you a movie. This is the ratio of those two channels, which is roughly 1. The scale isn't on here. These are the post-flare loops. The very hot plasma shows up as the green and the orange. Okay, and you see that it moves up. As these things form, it moves on up above them. Okay, I have a movie of that. And I'll just play it several times. That this very high temperature plasma is above those post-flare loops at all times, and it keeps moving up away from them.
Mm-hmm.
Here's your model of it. this is nanoflare, the Cargill nanoflare model. What we did, we took a set of loops and we released energy into them and just moved that energy source up. Okay, so yeah, it's a pretty simple-minded model, but in fact it reproduces the behavior pretty well. This is just the cooling part. Let me show you the whole thing. That simple model actually reproduces the brightening and most of the cooling quite well, except for this. This is a standard problem that has always been in flares, that late in the cooling phase, things last longer than they should have. But we still have that problem. I've been talking for an hour now.
Yeah, this is the integrated light curve of that whole region. Is that, I remember you said that.
I think this was just a sample place on the loop, just to give it, just to fit this brightening history.
Just trying to think of what that, yeah, what it is we're seeing that has this continuing heating.
There was a preprint that I just got just before coming here, suggesting. I don't know if you've seen some of those last Yoko observations where they overexpose the images and way high up you see stuff coming down into the flare.
McKenzie and
Hudson stuff. He was saying, well, if this is mass falling back down into the flare from what's been sent upward, maybe it's heating. So he calculated how much heating you could get from this downflow. I don't know if you remember, that was one of the early models, the early proposals for, I think, for providing the energy to power the sun. So, you know, the sun has a strong gravitational field. You can get a lot of heating. So that was his proposal for why you'd get that kind of a tail on the heating.
Who was that?
That was Shibasaki, actually. The only explanation I've ever seen that might even give you an answer to this one. You know, other people have thought maybe our conduction models are wrong, but this would actually be another energy source that hadn't been considered.
What was the energy source?
It was the material falling back down. You know, when there's a flare, you get material ejected upwards, and you see a lot of it falling back downward.
Isn't that like the old Charlie Hyder?
Right. Yes. Yeah. But in this case, you know, there is a plausible source for this material. You saw it go up. You see it come down often. So, anyway, I don't know. I've got other stuff I could go on, but maybe I should stop now. I'll say what? Give me 2 minutes, and I'll finish this. This is a flare seen in our carbon-4 passband on trace. And I actually wanted Eric and Terry to see this, because in addition to the flare ribbons, I think you see separatrix surfaces intersecting the surface here. Okay? I think that's where your separatrix intersects the surface. And you see it really well in carbon-4. You don't see it so well in the other passbands. But I don't know what else would give you this when this is where the flare is happening. Okay. Harry Warren did, he took these brightenings, and the ones you see right at the start of the event. Now, there's a model that says that you get particles accelerated from above, come crashing down, at least, you know, what's called the impulsive phase of a flare. So you get these little footpoint brightenings that should correlate with hard X-ray emission and microwave emission. And then later on, you get the stuff evaporating up into the corona. So in this case, all we had was the light curves of the hard X-ray emission. Crystal spectrometers give you this. They don't give you imaging. They don't tell you where the hard X-rays are coming from. They just tell you when they're happening. So he took these 6-foot points that, you know, the most prominent ones we saw in the flare, and tried to correlate it with these bursts in hard X-rays. And these are minutes down here. Okay, so these are fairly short timescales. And the upshot is you can get anything you want, any correlation you want. Sometimes some of these brightenings that we see correlate well with these hard X-ray bursts. Some of them, you know, just don't correlate at all. There's one that happens before there's anything in X-rays. This is a correlation map, and you can see that regions right next to each other can be well correlated and very poorly correlated at quite close locations. And I'll end there by saying that now that HESI is up, which is a satellite that will give us the hard X-ray observations with good timing and with spatial resolution, and we've got trace showing where these brightenings are, we might be able to figure it out. That just for 30 years, people have been trying to make sense out of what's seen. I'll put it that way. If we don't have a picture that hangs together. Maybe now we will. And I'll stop there. Yes?
Question about the overshoot of the actual flare compared to the theoretical model. What assumptions go into the theoretical model?
Well, the assumption was that you have energy input which stops after some amount of time, and then all that you're seeing after that is a relaxation. Basically, material is cooling either by conduction or by radiation.
What determines the length of time that the energy is input, and what's the general
Okay. Typically, this problem shows up most prominently in what are called long-duration events. So it's things where the energy release that you can see goes on for a few minutes, the cooling goes on for hours.
So I mean, the minute time scale is the assumed time scale for the dampening of energy.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's the physical concept. There's equivalence. What one uses for the duration of the energy is the sun. And that's what I was doing. I mean, I understand that the proposal is that to sustain it for longer than that might help, but just wondering what the usual motivation
is. Yeah, I didn't show you a lot of flare data, but it's pretty obvious when the flare is happening. You see things brighten up, and that only goes on for a fairly short amount of time. And then you have all these lingering after effects.
But I mean, show my ignorance, but my memory was the hard X-ray is that it stopped to be mostly from non-thermal particles, isn't it? And there's not
yes.
a thermal piece in the non.
Yes.
So I guess the question is, was everything until here you said was all thermal?
Right.
So this is the first non-thermal piece of physics, huh?
It's probably non-thermal, yes. I think that debate is, that was debated for many years. I think everybody's agreed now it's non-thermal.
So if that's the case, then I mean, you've learned about, you know, mean the thermodynamics of the thermal stuff. And for the there's nothing in what you've said that would tell you where the non-thermal activity is occurring,
except there are a lot of people who work with the belief that all of the energy in a flare is coming from the particles that have been accelerated.
And so there's some spatial information too, like HXT on Yoko showed almost all of the hard X-ray emission occurred in the foot points. Like where the flare
ribbons
are.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's rare. And you have to go to an occulted event where you don't see the foot points to be able to study the rooftop emission.
Would you agree that it's safe to say that it's fair to say there's still this debate about the Newport effect?
Well, right. There's some
there are people who think that all the stuff we see is just due to particles that have been accelerated and have been deposited. There's the particle acceleration. It's very quick. It deposits all its energy down in the corona, and then we see a flare after that.
We see the soft X-rays.
We see the soft X-rays.
The same with that bursty profile.
Right, you see microwave emission with this bursty profile. Some people say it's protons. Big debate about whether it's electrons or protons.
Slamming non-thermal relativistic particles slamming into a dense plasma.
Yes.
And then this is just the afterglow.
I don't think they're that relativistic.
Well, what if they're non-thermal?
They're 10-20 kV, I guess.
20 to 100 kilovolts.
Yeah.
Which is below the rest mass. So
yeah.
Not relativistic.
I guess. This belief arises by working backwards. If you take the amount of emission you see in X-rays and you work backward to what the particle population was, you get a lot of energy in the particles.
You get
about as much as there is in the whole event, and comparable to the sum of everything you see in soft X-rays.
I think the problem with the non-thermal particle picture, if it's all emitted at the front, is that if you look at the characteristic cooling time, it's actually quite short compared to the duration of the flare. And so then there's this other problem. There's additional energy needed.
Well, there's also the additional problem that my picture of what a flare is like is you get a soft X-ray curve like that, and the impulsive phase is usually there, not there. So I don't know if this debate is still alive. I guess it is.
But let me understand. The hard X-rays are thought to be from fast what's the emission mechanism? Fast is non-thermal spectral.
Yeah.
Okay.
Still, you see these bursts. You see these hard X-ray bursts, and nobody, I think, has been able to figure out what effect they have. What comes next? They're depositing energy down there. there are soft X-ray loops that come and go that brighten it up in the corona. It's not possible to put that together in a consistent way with where the hard X-ray events are.
Well, I guess I'm wondering is, you know, if have a beam of particles, I mean, the protons will penetrate much bigger than electrons. Electrons stop much sooner.
Yeah, well, you see gamma ray lines. Yeah,
exactly.
So.
Presumably people have done this, but you can imagine that the reason you're seeing two different, I mean, the hard X-ray pulse, that's all the electrons. And you can imagine that the baryons, which go in deeper, don't give you a local heating rate quite as large because they don't stop as fast.
You know, it's a matching different effects from the, yeah, a beam of particles coming in as neutral and they have electrons and baryons that you get a different energy composition rate. That was a favorite model for white light flares like 20 years ago. It was protons, and then somebody, there was some observable consequence of that that wasn't observed. I forget, I can't remember either, but this will all get cleaner with HESI. I expect that it will, it certainly should.
HESI will have gamma ray diagnostics as the goal, isn't it?
Will they see gamma ray lines?
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm hopeful that both of these satellites, TRACE and HESI, keep operating long enough that we can put their data together.
In these models, I guess the big connection goes up above the top of the room, right? Mm-hmm. The connection goes up on the top and sends you through the ground.
Yeah, the experts in this will be showing up tomorrow.
Yeah.
Eric Priest and Terry Forbes. But
I mean, I sort of know the picture, and I'm just wondering, so if it's possible that the inflow of plasma lasts longer than the time scale for the material to bang down to the surface as you heat up the loop, so that you haven't closed the reconnection by the time the first pulse of hot gas.
I think you should ask Terry.
About what? Sorry.
I'm not quite sure I understand what the question was.
The source of the initial gas that goes down to the foot points is the reconnection event, which is sending.
No, that's the source of the energy.
Yeah.
But there's a reconnection event up here.
Right.
Okay.
It sends
accelerated particles or energy in some form. The source of the gas is here.
Right.
You evaporate the chromosphere up.
But as soon as you evaporate the stuff up, now you have material coming up and potentially still material coming down.
Well, it's evaporating up into closed field lines. These lines have reconnected already.
Okay, so there's no intersection between the downflowing material, I guess.
Yeah, what you get is a moving sequence of events that progresses outward.
In the reconnection region, it's often thought there's a shock between the outflow jet and the ambient moving plasma. That is not a shock formed by the interaction with the upflow and the other stuff.
Yeah, there is another big mystery in all of this, that some events, you see a hard X-ray source right up there.
Only if you go to hold the bottom, noise.
Yeah. Well, HESI should be able to see that nicely, shouldn't it?
Is there any other questions? Let's zoom out again.
Okay. It was a pleasure.
Very nice.